Unsavory will attest if at first you don't succeed, try, try again. Alan began his lifelong career as a research biologist and game ranger in Rhodesia about 50 years ago. Now, as founder and director of the Savory Institute, his focus is on holistic management, reversing land degradation and desertification. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Alan, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
I guess in 1955, when you were working in Africa to restore and keep habitats thriving, it seemed that large populations of wild animals, such as elephants and hippos, were responsible for destroying their habitats. Many still hold this opinion today, but can you walk us through this history that you experienced and bring us up to the moment when you realized large game was not the problem?
Yes, when I began there and I joined the game department, we were really setting aside very marvelous big game areas as future national parks. We didn't have any national parks in the country, and they were very, very beautiful with high numbers of elephants and lions and buffalo. Sometimes you couldn't count them. There were just so many. And all these signs of deterioration began getting worse and worse pretty quickly. And we attributed that to us giving the animals sanctuary and thinking, well, they're sort of concentrating more on these areas now, and there are too many of them. So it was very common talk and belief that we had mainly too many elephants, but also hippo, buffalo, a few other things. I described in the TED Talk how I just followed up with that and did the research in those areas and the lower Zambezi, because I moved to southern Rhodesia and we had the same problem there, and proved, inverted commas, that there were too many, established the amount of damage of trees and riverine shrubs and bushes and reed beds were disappearing, and attributed all of this to too many elephants. I came to the conclusion, reluctantly, that we had no other option but to reduce numbers, the same as people have thought throughout history with livestock, and that was very, very unpopular. But after having my work investigated by a team of scientists, they agreed with my findings, recommendations, everything. It was a very stormy period with a tremendous lot of opposition to that, resulting in me eventually leaving the game department with so many accusations against my character and so on. But the culling of the elephants, as they call it, went ahead, and it got worse. And that's no different from what's happened with livestock. As we've steadily decreased livestock around the world, the situation has got worse, not better. And that's what I showed in extreme form with the TED Talks, where, with the pictures I showed, where all livestock were removed totally in research plots and in those national parks, extreme desertification occurred. So it really was just a big, big learning.
Was it the work that you came upon from the French agronomist André Voisin that helped start to shift your direction?
Direction, it wasn't quite as neat as that. We still believed that if we could get rid of the livestock, when I say we, I was working with American Fulbright scholars, Ray Dasman and Archie Mosman. Ray's written textbooks on wildlife, and Archie was professor of wildlife management at Humboldt. We worked for about 4 years together in Africa, and we really believed that if we could get rid of the livestock, we could manage the wildlife and improve the land. But then I began to get experiences that indicated this wasn't true. One area, we had all the livestock died, thousands of head of cattle, and then 50,000 head of game died, approximately, from the land degradation. And I published a paper that's embarrassing today, that was accepted by Pierce, so it was published, in which I virtually said that the land had got so bad it could no longer recover. So that again was a big mistake, because similar land to that, we later produced amazing recovery, but not until we greatly increased the animal numbers on them. So there was this long period of real confusion when nobody in the world knew any better what to do. We didn't, and were struggling. And then a turnaround came in many ways when an old ranching couple came to see me. And there was such antagonism between ranching people and myself because of my dislike of livestock, along with many other environmentalists, that I was very surprised that they came to my home. And I couldn't be rude. I said, come in and have some tea. And what's it about? And they told me that they really loved their land and had followed all the advice of research station nearby and government extension services, but they had to admit that their land was getting worse, not better. And really, that was quite a shock to me to know that they loved the land just as much as I did. So I agreed to start helping them, but on one condition. I said, you have to understand that I have no solutions. I'm only trying to find answers, and so it's going to be the blind leading the blind. But that actually began to make me work with livestock. And then I started literally seeking everything I could, just for clues, looking at the research of many countries, hundreds of range papers. I couldn't find any clues, anything I could use in management. And about that time, I came across two things. One was Ann's work. I had actually owned his book for some time and never really studied it. Now that I was working with livestock, I began studying it and found one of the clues there, that overgrazing had nothing to do with animal numbers. So that was a big clue for me, and how Wasan had tried to solve the problem in Europe on pastures, which were different from what I was dealing with, but similar principles. And about that time, I also read an article in a farming magazine that was just lying on a coffee table, one of the ranchers I was working with, and it was by a fellow called John Acox in South Africa, a botanist who was studying the advance of the desert there and how it affected the plant community. And he'd written an article, which was titled by him, that South Africa was overgrazed and understocked. In other words, lots of overgrazing, but too few animals. And that was a shocking statement. It produced a lot of ridicule of John from professional people, range scientists and so on. But to me, it was a new thought. So I actually drove in my car right down to the Cape to go and see him. I was working independently by then and battling to survive as an independent scientist. I remember the trip awfully well because it was midwinter and I couldn't even afford to buy a jersey, and it was damn cold. I talked to John about what he was doing, what his thinking was. Some of it made sense. And I asked if I could see it on the land. And he introduced me to a farming couple, Len and Denise Howell. And so I went and stayed with them and went on the land with them. And they were trying to force sheep to eat everything in small areas and then move them on a simple rotation like that. And I wasn't too impressed with a lot of what I was seeing. But when I stopped to open a gate at one point, I saw a little bit of the land in a corner that looked amazingly good, just what I was looking for. And so I rushed over there, all excited, and they asked why I was so excited, and I pointed out that the plants were greener, healthier, denser, better soil cover, all the sort of things I'd seen under fairly intact wildlife populations. And it appeared that the sheep had crowded into a corner there and then been moved away, so that it had a very high physical impact, trampling, dunging, urinating, and then a recovery period. And that was a major aha moment. From that moment on, I just knew we could do it with livestock if we could work out how to do it.
Yes, and Alan, I certainly think you deserve a lot of credit for being able to honestly look at your mistakes and then come back very strongly with great answer and now great sustainable ecological work that's going on today. I'm very happy you've gotten the time to do some reparations and keep things moving and changing, which is a key, of course, to the livestock, having them go in large numbers. But the amount of time they spend on the land is certainly a key point, isn't it?
Well, it is. The desertification, you know, land turning to desert, is basically just too much bare soil. And it's easy to explain it in hindsight, but it took me many, many years to sort it out because of thousands of years of misbeliefs and those becoming scientific truths and so on. But today, in hindsight, I can explain it fairly easily, that anywhere in the world on land, in general, you will not find a very high level, in other words, millions of acres of land showing a lot of bare ground between the plants in certain areas. That's like the east and west coast of the United States or England, Sweden, whatever, because it's so humid that anything that would have caused bare ground, nature covers it up quickly. And so you only see any large areas of bare ground under cropping practices. And that's generally not millions and millions of acres. Now, anywhere else in the world, roughly about two-thirds of the world's land, most of the United States, Australia, vast areas of Africa, right through the former Soviet republics to China, etc., there it's very easy to get a high percentage of the soil bare between the plants. And fortunately, that only results from two things. So it actually becomes fairly simple, although we just couldn't see it for thousands of years. The two things that lead to a high percentage of bare soil, and I stress between the plants, are one is fire, using fire to try to maintain grasslands, and the other thing is just simply too few grazing animals wandering on the land. And when they wander on the land, they really do two things. They overgraze plants because of frequency of grazing, not because of their numbers. So they overgraze some of the plants, and they overrest the land. And that overresting of the land, you saw the desertification effect of that in the pictures I showed in the TED Talk.
Yes, biological decay is key. Starting fires don't remedy that situation.
Yeah, the animals and their physical impact, dunging, urinating, and trampling litter to cover soil is the key. If they aren't there, that's why it turns to oxidation in those climates, in sunlight, the dead grass material, and that's why we burnt.
There's always been so much controversy about that, so it's great to have more reasoning about why it really does not work. In restoration, soil carbon, water retention, capacity to hold nutrients are all three necessary points to work with. And maybe you can tell a little bit about each one and how they are remedied with this type of work.
Let me try and express it simply so most people can get it. And any gardener understands this, actually, that if you have a covered, healthy soil full of life, and there's a mass of life in the soil of microorganisms, fungi and algae and bacteria and you name it, worms and beetles and everything. If you have the soil covered and full of life like that, it is an enormous reservoir, if you like, for both carbon, because all life is basically carbon, and for water retention. In fact, the soil is our biggest single place where fresh water occurs that's unfrozen. It's greater than all the lakes, dams, rivers put together. And carbon and water, their fate tends to follow one another. So if you have very healthy grassland soils in particular, they tend to develop great depth over time and be enormous reservoirs of carbon and water. I don't think there's any mystery to the great grain-growing cropping areas of the world being on former grassland soils. They're not on former forest soils. It's under grasslands that we can develop these deeper soils holding much more carbon and water. It's not to belittle the forest soils, it's just saying the grasslands are bigger areas of the world and can develop more water and carbon holding capacity as far as we know. And all of that begins to happen amazingly well if you keep the soil covered. So the key to the cycling of nutrients between the soil, back to plants, animals, the key to retaining water in the soil effectively so that it soaks in and only leaves through plants or underground flow through the soil to perennial river flow, aquifers, wetlands, wells, boreholes, etc., is again cover of the soil. The key to maximizing the bulk of the diversity, the biological diversity of life above and below the soil, again becomes the key to it is the cover of the soil. And then likewise, that influences more than anything the total flow of energy through the entire system. So when you look in any one of these windows, nutrient cycle, water cycle, biological community dynamics and synergy that's going on, or the total energy flow through to all life, it's like looking into one room through four different windows. And if you want to know what the key to all of them are, is it's a cover of the soil surface. We expose the soil, they all tend to go wrong. If we keep the soil covered, nature's amazingly forgiving.
I have seen some statistics regarding the CO2, the carbon dioxide, and water. And with just 1% increase of carbon dioxide, it reduces the actual water needed for growing plants by 30%.
Yeah, I see and I read all these things, but to me, they are side. I'm not saying they're unimportant, but they're side issues. The world is in desperate trouble, desperate, with climate change denial and all the things that are going on. And one of the points I've been making in talks around Europe, Australia, and everywhere else is saying we have to focus, if we're going to save trillions of dollars in catastrophes that are mounting and save millions of human lives in the years ahead, we have to really focus. And so let me assume some things that are not true. Let me assume that the world's savannas, grasslands, soils, seasonal rainfall environments, again, about two-thirds of the world land, that it could absorb absolutely no carbon, no excess carbon from the atmosphere. Let me assume that livestock put out 10 times the methane they do from digesting vegetation. Make those two assumptions, and what are you going to do? You still have absolutely no option but to use livestock properly managed to reverse desertification, because desertification is leading to increasing droughts and floods in both severity and frequency, and that is cumulative. It gets steadily worse and worse. It's leading to social breakdown, poverty, violence, abuse of women and children, recruitment to dissident organizations, mass emigration to Europe, etc. You read about these drowning boat people trying to cross the Mediterranean. It's leading to all of these things and to climate change. And if we don't use livestock properly managed, there is nothing else available to scientists and managers of land to reverse desertification. So when people academically argue about how much carbon can be absorbed, where is the data, how can we measure it. These are all nice issues that we need to solve, but we should not hold up progress in beginning to reverse desertification globally. And I believe this very strongly, and no scientist, to my knowledge, has ever shown where my reasoning is wrong.
It's interesting in the United States, for instance, that there are basically about the same amount of cattle in feedlots now that compares to the number of bison that used to roam free. And what happened? They were roaming free and moving about, creating more grassland. And if you look at the beef that come from the feedlots that are fed corn or whatever else they're fed, and then you look at the grass-fed cattle produce so much less methane than the corn-fed.
Yeah.
When you're going out into an area and you're going to start shifting it, what is it like? Do you bring in the livestock? Do you have to feed them supplementarily initially? How does that work?
Now, every situation is unique, but the answer is very simple, really. We never, ever have had to feed the animals, except when we're doing mine reclamation work. When you're doing mine reclamation work, or you have 100% bare ground, there is nothing to eat, then you have to feed the animals. But on rangeland situations, and I've dealt with some of the worst imaginable in the world, if there is some vegetation on that land supporting some animals, we begin with that. And a way of looking at it is, if I shave one side of my face every couple of days, nothing grows, but the other side, a lot of hair would grow. Well, the land is like that. Plants, when the rain comes, are trying to grow. But if animals are on the land wandering around, they just keep nipping them off, nipping them off, nipping them off, as though you were shaving the land, so nothing grows. So if we take any area of land and it's got X number of animals on it doing that, and we divide the land up into units, blocks, paddocks, whatever we call them, and these can be with fencing or they can be virtual paddocks where we just herd the animals. As long as we can divide it up, then what we do is bunch the animals up into a small part of the land for a very short time. So there's enough food for them to eat because they're only there for a very short time. But that's letting the plants on all the rest of the land begin to grow. Then we plan the move to another piece of land, doing the same thing and the same thing as we move across that land. And so what you have happening is on 80-90% of the land at any given day, all the plants are able to grow, while where the animals are, they're there for so short a time that even plants they bite are not overgrazed because the animals move on, and so those plants are immediately able to grow. And before ever going loose on the public at large, we tested that out on a big ranch in Rhodesia in those days. It was over a million-acre ranch, 60,000 cows, and the southern part of the ranch had desertified extremely badly, and they wanted my advice and my help. And I said to them, look, what I want to do is condemned by everybody. I don't have anybody who agrees with me, and I don't want you to take any risk believing in me. So they said, what do you propose? And I asked them to give me free access to the worst land they had, and let me show them what could be done, and then if they were confident, we'd move on. Well, they gave me 4,000 acres of that land, and it was in terrible condition with few animals on it, no perennial grass at all. I'd have given you $100 if you could have found a single perennial grass plant, but it had trees, some shrubs, leaf fall, twigs, things animals could eat. And when we got rain, it would get annual grasses. So anyway, on that, what I did was to push it to breaking point, to try to cause failure, if I could, with the planning process that I had developed. And we just couldn't break it. It just got better and better and better. We went to three times the animal numbers by the end of the first year. trying to see if we could make it fail.
You actually took the 60,000 cattle and put it on?
No, not the 60,000. We took the animals that 4,000 acres was capable of running.
So how many would that be?
Let's say it was 100 animals. So I went to 300 animals within the first year. I just went to three times the numbers
yes.
right away to show what could be done and to push it very hard to either prove it right or wrong. And it just became solid perennial grassland. So we then got going with all the rest of the ranch and the 60,000 cattle.
Wonderful. Does it seem to you, Alan, that environmentalism has gotten too myopic, maybe for its own good?
I don't know the answer to that. You know, that's such a broad word. There are environmentalists with amazingly good grasp of what's going on, and some with very narrow views of what biodiversity involves and so on. Let me make one point. I don't like blaming, because nobody is to blame for the situation we're in, but a major part of it is our compartmentalized, fragmented education, you know, fiefdoms of knowledge, etc. And it's very hard to pull it together for the public, as we're going to have to do to survive. So if I take three issues, biodiversity loss, okay, that's an issue, and you find separate environmental groups, conferences, environmental organizations, biologists and so on working on it, largely about charismatic species, but not entirely. Then if you look at desertification, you have another issue, and you have separate international organizations, range scientists working on it, separate conferences. And then if you take climate change, you have the same thing, separate concerned organizations, conferences, etc. But backing off a moment, if you look at it, desertification simply does not occur without loss of biodiversity. It is really only a symptom of the loss of microorganisms, litter, soil cover, which is all part of biodiversity, not charismatic species, but biodiversity as a whole. And if we do not address desertification, the point I was making earlier, we cannot address climate change. So the ideal would be to be having people work right across this, just as we're doing at our institute, and to have conferences and meetings in the world where people are discussing this as one single issue.
Alan, I know you have an e-book.
Okay, that's available on the TED site. They've done, I think, a very good job. They really pushed me hard with all their fact-checking. And it's elaborated more on the talk, giving much more detail on what the holistic planned grazing is. And then it's dealt with some of the main criticisms, which has always been very difficult. But I think we've handled it well there. When I say very difficult, it's for one reason. It's because we've had almost no legitimate criticism of what managing holistically is. We've had an enormous amount. I've had 50 years of it, criticism of what it isn't. So that makes it always very difficult. If you're trying to respond to criticism of something that you're not doing, you come over as defensive, and it just gets messy. So we've tried very clearly in writing in a short book to clarify some of that.
Alan Savory. His site is savoryinstitute.com. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.